Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm a performance artist who fights the Anglo-capitalist hegemony. Unless my acceptance of fellowships and curation jobs with increasingly prestigious arts institutions means that I'm a hypocrite with false consciousness. Even though I am a truculent institutional critic, I'm going to co-direct a show at the Whitney next year. And right now, I'm doing this residency at the Guggenheim. This is G.P. Gottlieb, host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I'm talking to Ixta Maya Murray, law professor and author of Art is Everything. In social media posts, rejected reviews on Yelp, unauthorized descriptions of museum art, and stream of consciousness rants, Murray tells the story of a woman whose dreams of being an artist are sidelined. Amanda Ruiz has a loving girlfriend and is a successful performance artist with a number of credits and honors under her belt. Then her father dies. Her girlfriend leaves her. She's sexually assaulted. And she can't find her way back to her art. Murray's erudite musings venture beyond tales of performance artists to stories of philosophers, writers, and scientists who discovered something that Amanda needs to learn in order to live an authentic life. Hi, Ixta. Thanks for joining me today.
Hey, Khalid. I'm thrilled to be here with you today talking about books.
So I just spoke to you about 6 months ago about your book of short stories, and now we're talking about your novel. And you also have a full-time job as a law professor. So do you ever sleep?
No, I don't sleep that well, but I'm trying to get better on that account. I'm pretty busy, but I love it.
So can you talk a bit about your own background in art, your art criticism, and your process for writing Art is Everything?
Absolutely. Thanks so much. So yeah, the novel's called Art is Everything. And I began writing it about 2.5 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, which is around the same time that I started to write art criticism for art journals. So my progress towards writing about art, I'm a law professor, as you noted, and I had written about art in legal periodicals, doing kind of theoretical work around sexual assault and, for example, the work of Tracy Emin, who's this wonderful British artist. But slowly I started to think that maybe some of the writing that I was doing about art in law could be translated into arts periodicals. And I had this experience. I went to the Los Angeles County Museum of Art in around 2016 or 2017. And I saw this phenomenal retrospective of the work of Agnes Martin, who was this minimalist and who's famous for making these graph paintings, these really spare paintings that often just have a series of lines in them. And her work sounds really simple, and it is very simple in a lot of ways, been complex in others. But I also noticed that LACMA had not mentioned on its, when you go to a museum, there are all these signs on the walls or all these words on the walls. So that you're supposed to, little plates by the paintings where you get descriptions of the work. And I noticed that none of the text in the exhibit mentioned two things, which is that Martin was a lesbian and that she had also experienced schizophrenia of a fairly substantial degree, as far as I can tell within my reading, and in fact had gone to Bellevue and had experienced electroshock therapy. You know, anyway, so disability and sexuality weren't part of the didactics of the show, and I felt pretty frustrated about that. I thought it was important. And so I wound up writing an essay about art criticism, an arts criticism essay that I wound up sending to a magazine called Artillery Magazine, a wonderful magazine here in Los Angeles, whose editor is Tulsa Kinney. And she wound up taking it. And that began my life as an art critic, which has just added so much richness to my everyday experience. So I started writing a ton of arts criticism, particularly for Artillery, but I also started writing fiction about art. It just kind of started to morph into fictional writing. And the writings of my art criticism, which turned into fiction, later turned into art.
Ooh. And so is that how Amanda was born, your protagonist?
Yes. Amanda is a performance artist and a conceptualist. So a performance artist, I mean, these things sometimes belie a finite description or definition, but a performance artist, in my understanding of it, performs often with their body before an audience. They're not entertaining you. They're elaborating upon an idea or an emotion. There's often some shock value, which can be very enriching. Performance art takes on many different forms. So she does that. She does what she calls a critical race a burlesque show, which I stole from Zandra Ibarra, who's a Chicana artist who works sometimes in Los Angeles. Anyway, so she's this performance artist who does these kind of out there, really extreme performances. And she also considers herself a conceptualist, by which I mean that coming up with a concept itself and expressing it in some way, not necessarily in material form, is itself making art. So she's really kind of out there as an artist, but it can't be said that she is financially successful or, in fact, has really penetrated the higher temples of the art industrial complex. And so she's kind of operating on the fringes of the art world and making incredible art. That's a character, Amanda Ruiz, a bisexual Chicana performance artist conceptualist.
So you said in your answer to the previous question that you noticed that it was never mentioned that an artist was a lesbian. And
Agnes Martin.
Is that important to know about artists? Is it important to know about their personal lives?
Yeah, such a great question. And in fact, it's become particularly a present question in analyses of Agnes Martin herself. Some critics say that we should really just focus on the graph. The graph says everything. We don't need any other information. But maybe it's because of my background as a narrative artist, that is a writer, I'm always interested in the story. I'm always interested in who made the art and why they made it and what difficulties they had making it, and understanding the art through the prism of their lives. I can't help it. I can't disassociate the object from the story. And so for me, knowing these facts about the lives of artists, the lives of marginalized artists, people with mental health struggles, people who have a queer sexuality, is important not only just to understand the art, but also to bring forward, to articulate, and to acknowledge the diversity of artists and these really suppressed, erased identities. So I found it a form of queer erasure when Martin's sexuality was not described in the text of the show. So for me, it's critical on a couple of different levels. Yeah.
And your character also is upset about that sort of thing too. And she, here's what I'm wondering. How did you decide which of the characters would be fictional, like Amanda's a fictional character, and which, like the artists, are actual people? Are all the artists based on true stories of actual performance artists?
Yes, every single artist that's discussed and written about in this novel is a real artist. Agnes Martin, Joseph Boys, Marina Abramovich, Glenn Ligon, Laura Aguilar, all of them incredible artists at the top of their fields. Also some lesser known artists, like this one incredible artist named Lindsay Tunkel, who's a conceptualist and performance artist who I met at the Hammer when she was selling these crazy perfumes that she named after terms associated with the apocalypse. I mean, so yeah, all the artists are real, and it's Amanda herself who is in her relationships and the people in her world who are fictional.
wait a second. So you included pictures of some of her art, Lindsay Tunkel's art.
Yes.
She was the performance artist who was dunking her head into a bowl of water while singing.
Singing, right? I will always love you. Yeah.
I will always love you. What about Lindsay Tunkel's art was so provocative to Amanda? Was it because it was provocative to you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Amanda is a braver version of myself because she continues making art or trying to, even when her whole life collapses. Whereas I haven't been as stalwart as she is, but she's intrigued by an artist like Lindsay Tunkel. So Tunkel is amazing. She does things like tattoo or draw the word Holocene on the underside of her lip and then take photographs of it. And like I said, she makes these crazy perfumes and she designs tarot cards and she'll design these performance art actions based on calling a lover who no longer wants to talk to her time and time again as she's driving towards this person across California. And so it's the intensity of the art and the intensity of the artist. The idea that Amanda really wants to be in the presence of an artist who is hooked into the life force and hooked into things that are vivid and even painful. And Lindsay Tunkel most certainly is. I recommend her work to everyone who is listening to us today. You can find it on Vimeo and assorted other platforms. It's really wonderful.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
What defines someone as an artist? Is it their training, because they say they're artists, or because they earn money from their art?
It better not be because they earn money from it, because then I'm in a lot of trouble and so is Amanda. but the question of what makes someone an artist and what makes something art is a question that propels Amanda forward in her life. In part because she loses her father to a pretty destructive blood cancer, and she also breaks up or is abandoned by the love of her life, Sochi, this actuary who's really together, really cool. And anyway, she's lost everyone important in her life, and she still wants to make art. And the question for her is, when I'm just sitting here crying, like she tries to make art by crying into the dust on the windshield of her Prius, and she calls them action drawings, like after the action paintings of Jackson Pollock, those famous drip paintings. And she's like, is this art or am I just having a nervous breakdown? And that's her way of trying to keep connected to her art practice and also ask important questions about what it means to be alive and how one should live.
Well, as an art critic, can you differentiate art from suffering and from everything else out there?
Mm-hmm. So as an art critic and as a human being, I certainly can. I know that there are spaces where suffering does not ennoble. Suffering does not lead to creation. Suffering does not uplift or do anything else except for hurt, and that there is another space where that is generative, in even if it's painful, and that is, you know, bent on creation. And these things really can be divorced from each other. But a very fertile question is, can we make art from these spaces in our life that we would otherwise write off as null, void, dead, deadening. And it's her effort to revitalize her life from this anguish that leads her to attempt to make art out of her reactions to that which is painful in the world.
And she's suffering. She suffers after the breakup when Soshi breaks up with her, and she suffers from when her father dies, and she suffers from being sexually assaulted. Mm-hmm. And she makes art each time.
Every time she makes art. That's why she's the coolest, because she, for some reason, doesn't just get into a fetal position. She keeps on creating, like many great artists do. And it is that stamina and that tenacity that I admire so much, and that has been reflected in the lives of other women artists who I'm, you know, the most interested in, probably, like Tracy Emin, who was raped at the age of 13, who experienced several abortions that that were necessary for her, but that she also found maybe psychologically destructive, like Micheline Thomas, the great Black American lesbian painter, photographer, and installation artist, who lost her beloved mother, who was a muse to her and one of her subjects. And both of these artists, when faced with these catastrophes, had something within them that allowed them to make art in reaction to those losses. And there's something to learn in that. For me, and perhaps for other people as well. How can we create out of that which would otherwise ruin us?
Mm-hmm. Could we talk a bit about how Amanda reacts to the exhausted guard at the Museum of Modern Art, and how that leads to her falling in love again?
Yes.
Her thinking she's fallen in love again.
Yeah, she does. She does fall in love. I mean, we can get into a long question of what is self-interest and what is love. So I was at the Museum of Contemporary Art in New York, now many years ago, and I found this. So I walk into this room. It was completely based on my own experience in part. I walk into this room, where there's one man, a security guard. He's a Black man, and he is just standing there, and there's a sort of a silver thing at his feet. And everyone else in the room was white. I'm Mexican American. Everybody else appeared to be of Anglo ancestry, and nobody was looking at him, and he just seemed to be staring out into space. So I walk up to him and I'm like, "Hey, what's going on? What is this?" And he says, I don't know. It's art. And so I look down, and it's this little steel weight. And I found that it was attached to a plastic filament, a string that went all the way up to the ceiling. And I said, "Do you stand here all day looking at this string?" And he says, "Yes, I have to, because otherwise people would walk into it." And I said, How does that work for you?" And he says, "At the end of the day, I have to soak my feet." And it was pretty evident to me that he had been assigned a task that that no one should be assigned to do. That is to stand in one place, to stare at an invisible string, to have no one talk to you, or even seem to notice you. And it just struck me, and I'll talk about what the art is in a second. And it just struck me about how we walk into these museums in order to be transported and to connect to the life force and to learn something, but that within every room, there are conditions of inequality and even a kind of violence in some cases, if you could define being required to stand for many hours a day looking at an invisible string while people ignored you as a form of bodily and psychic violence. And so, and yet we are being trained through these art institutions to look away from the suffering and towards these multimillion-dollar works of art, which is a very negative form of social conditioning, which is the kindest way that I can put that. And so the art turned out to be a work called Untitled by an artist named Robert Berry. And he made it in the 1960s. And it's just, again, this metal weight attached to a plastic string that goes all the way up to the ceiling. And Berry said that he wanted to make art that was about nothing because he thought that nothing was the most important idea in the world. I might be mangling his quote, but it was something to that effect. And it occurred to me that it might be great for artists to make art about nothing. And it might be great for art lovers to waft around. Oh, there's the Museum of Modern Art. I apologize. It was MoMA in New York. I said MoCA. Such an Angelino. Anyway, so it might be great for people to waft around MoMA contemplating nothing and the history of art as according to Robert Berry, but that it's not good for nothing to be imposed upon a person as a condition of work. And that's how I saw what was going on with this garden. So I wound up writing the story about Amanda, who's trying to have this conversation with this guard, but feels weird, like she doesn't want to impose. She thinks that maybe she's exploiting him or embarrassing him. And then she winds up writing a long story or essay about the meaning of nothing, as well as, and the distinction between nothing and invisibility, because the string was supposedly invisible and the man, in some ways, with apologies to Ellison, truly was.
I really enjoyed that story. But I was wondering, shouldn't artists realize that if they create something that's going to require a guard, it's some of the responsibility falls on their shoulders? Or is it the museum that chose to put it in the middle of a room instead of in a corner where nobody could hurt themselves?
I think that's a great curatorial and social justice question. It has to be everybody's responsibility. It has to be everybody's responsibility. It has to be the responsibility of the institute, because no one vector is going to take care of this. It has to be the responsibility of the institution. It has to be the responsibility of the artist. It has to be the responsibility of the people who go to the museum and the people who write about it.
I also have a question. Maybe this is a coastal museum situation, but I'm relatively sure that at the Art Institute here in Chicago, when it's open to the public, I'm relatively sure that the guards take breaks in a consistent way, and they're not, and nobody's ever standing all day.
Yeah, that's right. Right. It's not a forced death march. So I wound, okay. Right. But I wound up doing some research on, as one does now, since it's all here on this little box that we call the computer, about the psychological effects of being a guard. And it turns out that being a guard in the way that I was witnessing at MoMA can be corrosive to one's mental health. So there were suggestions, like there are these suggestions that are made for guards, like, well, if you find yourself having difficulty just standing there all day without anybody talking to you and just looking at the same thing all day, then you can count the tiles in the floor, or you can count and see how many people come in wearing blue. And anyway, it's just, I think it's an important social problem to process. The art world has been the subject of great an important and necessary critique, particularly, and this has received very pretty high wattage in the last 5 or 6 years for a lot of different reasons. Where the money's coming from, right? Some of it comes from the drug industry, who is being represented at these museums. There's been, ever since the Guerrilla Girls, right, in the 1980s, who were protesting sexist curational and collection practices at museums, began shouting about this. We've been trying to alert to the problems of inequality and arts institutions, but the issues of guards is part of that, I think, critique as well. And I think it would, I tried to put in the voice of the person that I was speaking to. I don't want to speak for him. And it's just something that I noticed. And it's something that Amanda became very bothered by.
Yeah. Later in the book, Amanda says, art requires a distance, an artifice, an audience, a purpose apart. So what do you think differentiates art from non-art?
Yes. So I think that it's the intent of the artist. I think that what is art and what is not art is now determined by the intent of the artist as well as of the audience. And both of these forces together help debate, discuss, and determine whether something functions or qualifies as art. So for example, Marina Abramović, who I have previously mentioned, is probably, I'd have to say, the most famous living performance artist. Joseph Beuys, who is deceased, may be second or prior to her, more important than her in some kind of exhausting list of who is the most important performance artist. Nevertheless, Abramović has done things like The Artist is Present, which is her famous kind of show at MoMA, where she sat in a chair for I don't know how long and looked into the eyes of every single person who wanted to sit across from her at a table and simply share eye contact. And she did that for an extraordinarily long period of time. And she declared that to be art. So if looking in someone's eyes can be art, sanctioned by the great MoMA, I believe, and then many other things can also qualify as art. The question then becomes, is it good art, right? I think it's harder to establish what's good art than what is art. The definitions since Duchamp of what art is have expanded geometrically and wildly. But what is good? And for me, the definition of what is good art is that which communicates, that which inspires an idea or a feeling.
Hmm. I can only say it about music. And for me, what is good music is music I like. So
right. Right.
I think that's probably true for most people.
We're saying the same thing.
Yes. Yeah. So Ixtel, this is two books in 1 year. Within a year, I'm wondering what's next for you.
Mm-hmm. So I'm writing about a couple. I'm writing two different books. One is, so I found out a couple years ago that there had been a nuclear reactor meltdown in Simi Valley, about half an hour from where I live. In what was it? Yeah, the late 1950s, I believe, and that it had never been properly cleaned up. And so there's radionuclide contamination in Simi Valley's, there's this area called Santa Susana. There was this big experimental nuclear reactor facility there that was operating for many years. And there have been cancer clusters that erupted around there. And I decided that I would write a novel around this space that had been abandoned, like so many other places, by the government, and to tell the stories of the people who had worked there. So I'm working on that book, and I'm also working on another book about, I know this is probably, you can guess this one, asteroids. It's my little dog Babs. She's fussing. I'm writing about asteroids and about a woman who is a radar astronomer whose job is to detect dangerous near-Earth objects.
This one sounds really cool. They all sound, both sound cool.
Super.
Can't wait.
Yeah, it's pretty basic.
So good luck to you. Happy writing. Happy reading. Hope this is a year of, hope 2021 is a wonderful year. for us.
Galit, I thank you so much for speaking with me, and I wish you health and joy.
And thank you for joining me. Again, this is G.P. Gottlieb, author of the Whipped and Sipped Mystery Series and host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I've been talking with Ixta Maya Murray about her fascinating novel, Art is Everything. Hope all of you listeners are able to lose yourself in a good book today and tomorrow too. Happy reading.